As rumors fly that the potential sale of JEA is a done deal, we'll get the latest about what's going on behind the scenes. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or through our WJCT app. Just ahead, opposition is growing to the sale of JEA, but power players are arguing for privatizing the city's utility. Where do you stand? We'll have the latest just ahead. Call us up now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, we'll speak with Jeanette Walls, best-selling author of The Glass Castle, a memoir of growing up in poverty. It's a preview of her talk in Jacksonville next week, plus Culpepper on all the local ties to the Winter Olympics. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, we've got the latest in what has become a controversial proposal to see if Jacksonville would benefit from selling off its public utility, JEA. On Friday, JEA requested a meeting with the Jacksonville City Council to present what's called a valuation report that came out in draft form last week. Now, JEA Board Chair Alan Howard requested the meet and that it be held this Wednesday when the final report is expected to be released. The utility, JEA, well, it's valued in excess of $5 billion. Power players are arguing for a sale, saying it could benefit the city enormously financially. But some local legislators are already showing skepticism about the potential benefits of a sale. And the public is getting restless about this, too. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics has been following the story, and he joins us now with that and some other news and notes from the political world. Hey, A.G., good morning.
Thanks for having me.
The number to join us as we talk about the sale of JEA, where do you stand? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we're already getting your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Man, we talked about this on Friday, and it was a hot one. So hot, in fact, that we decided to talk about it again today. You have new information. What's happening this morning?
Well, late Friday, the board of JEA, board chair of JEA, requested a meeting of the Jacksonville City Council on Wednesday to discuss the valuation report that was released in draft form last week that essentially recommended that if you're going to explore a sale, the time is now. Council President Brochet deliberated on it over the weekend. I had texted her this morning. She said that she's going to decline the meeting, which led to pushback almost immediately from the mayor's chief of staff, Brian Hughes, which basically boiled down to, you know, we have to report. You know, everybody can look at it now. You want transparency. What's the issue? So you're seeing these issues royal up again between the mayor's office and council president. But the larger issue is that JEA has a valuation draft report. They all have the final product on Wednesday. It says that if you're going to sell, this is the best time to explore it that we've seen. People, connect with the mayor's office. They share that interpretation. They basically say that, when the stock market's in correction territory, which it is right now with the reversals last week, people are looking for other things with their money. Something like buying a utility may be attractive, and it's worthwhile exploring the sale. There's no preliminary sale out there. There's no quid pro quo agreement with Florida Power and Light or something, some people have suggested. But what they do want to explore the sale. They want to see who wants to buy it. They want to see if those people who want to buy it are plausible buyers. But the council president's going to take her own, she has her own schedule. And, ultimately council makes the decision. And, council president Brochet wants to slow walk it a little bit, clearly.
Some of the potential suitors that have been reported, everyone from Duke Energy to Tampa Electric, Florida Power and Light, Southern Energy. We'll talk about issues with some of those players in a moment that some of our listeners are tweeting about to us. But so Council President Brochet slow walking this. Why?
There's a school of thought on the council. There are people who, want to have a referendum on it, but this is not a referendum issue. That would be super legislative in the eyes of the general council. So it can't be a referendum issue. Council has to decide yes or no. But people want council feedback. There was a meeting of city council members last week regarding the issue. Councilwoman Katrina Brown said she wanted town halls throughout her district. A couple of council people had the referendum idea. There's a lot of apprehension in terms of individual council people in terms of, pulling the trigger on this. But, here's the rub. If council does not come together and say we're willing to explore a sale, it's going to discourage buyers, including, the buyers who might make the best offer. It's like, ironically enough, if, there's, a tentativeness among city policymakers, what will happen is people say, yes, I'm interested in this asset, interested in subdividing the asset, maybe the electric or maybe the water or whatever. They'll basically say, well, we don't want to do this because we're not sure what you people want.
Much pushback is council getting from their constituents about this?
Well, I mean, there's pushback. I mean, the meeting that I attended Tuesday, it was largely JEA employees. There are a lot of linemen there, some Democratic activists. Is it this positive pushback? Is it a kind of pushback that's going to lose your reelection? Yeah, I don't know about that. But this is one of those big picture issues that Lenny Curry prides himself on, sort of like pension reform a couple years ago. And, there's always a certain tentativeness in terms of, Jacksonville politicians and these big issues, these big ticket items. And this seems to be no exception.
It's 549-2937. Let us know where you stand on selling JEA. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Two bills have already been filed, as you've reported, at the council around this. One would set up a lockbox reserve account for the proceeds of the sale of the utility, some $5 billion. That would require a supermajority of the council and mayoral approval to spend, at least for the first year. Right. Another bill would bind JEA to install sewage lines throughout part of the service area. Plenty of old neighborhoods are still on septic tanks, and that's something that goes back decades. So people have asked a lot of questions about this. What's going to happen to our water and sewer service if, say, another electric company buys our utility?
Yeah, and these bills should be talked about separately. I want to talk about the lockbox one first because Matt Schellenberg, the councilman who filed it, he's the JEA liaison from council. He's been interested in exploring privatization since he got on council, basically. He says it's an asset. We need to know what it's worth and go from there. Schellenberg, in talking to me last week, said that, perhaps the electric could be sold off and the water could be kept or vice versa. That's really one of the things. Now, with that particular bill, if you were to sell it, you'd have that stuff in the lockbox, that revenue for the first year. After that, it'd probably be swept into a general fund because you can't bind future councils. That's the theory there. The second bill is filed by the council members from District 7 through 10 and at-large Councilman Sam Newby regarding the septic. I mean, it's one of those broken promises of consolidation issues we talked about so much in this program. For decades, they've been saying they'd get these old neighborhoods on city sewer. It hasn't happened. The project is supposed to cost anywhere between $300 million and $1 billion. There's already a septic phase out happening right now, but consider where it's at. It's five years, $30 million dedicated to it. So that's a small fraction of what needs to be done. So basically what the council members want there is to bind. In either case, these are people who are saying that let's proceed as if this is going to happen, even though they are council people. They haven't moved on that yet, but they're kind of putting the cart before the horse with these bills, some people might say. But it's a measure of how seriously the proposal is being taken and how seriously the mayor's office political clout is.
The council is nominally an independent body, right? They don't have to rubber stamp everything the mayor's office wants.
Well, they don't. And in this case, there's a lot of pushback on it. Obviously, you're going to get that. You've got JEA workers who would be impacted. You've got questions about, well, what kind of recourse we have if there are service issues. Like, consider the last hurricane. Jacksonville was restored within a week. Places on Florida Power and Light, they took a bit longer. Places on Duke Energy took a bit longer. And that's because you got bigger service areas. You don't have accountability. You don't have the ability of council and the mayor's office to press for these things to happen quicker. You don't have control over the mutual aid agreements. I mean, these are real considerations. Would $1 billion of profit, $2 billion of profit ameliorate those considerations? That's an open question. And another open question is, in the way power is delivered right now, is it going to be the way it is perpetually? Ron Littlepage, former Times Union columnist, tweeted about this. In 20 years, you know, solar may change the game.
Sure. Even sooner.
Yeah. I mean, so, and the way it is with JEA right now, it's like, even though the city's getting bigger, even though businesses are expanding, even though we've been in the kind of economic boom that leads to business expansion, you know, usage has trailed off on electric because, you know, appliances get more efficient and so on. So you got a company with increasing legacy cost, increasing infrastructural cost, you know, dovetailing with the decrease in demand because, you know, as could have been predicted years ago, decades ago, power usage has gotten more efficient, appliances have gotten more efficient, and so on.
Let's go to your calls now as we talk about the latest on the potential sale of JEA. 549-2937. This morning we've learned that the city council president has brushed back a request from the board chair of the utility to meet this week to discuss this. Bobby on the north side. Go ahead, Bobby.
Good morning. Thank you for the in-depth reporting on this. It's amazing the city of Jacksonville leadership, quote-unquote, takes the only thing that actually works in the city and tries to sell it off. It's sort of the analogy that I would use is you take a mortgage with a bank, the bank sells a mortgage, and then they call in, and then they decide to sell your house out from underneath you when you've made your mortgage payments and you've done the improvements. And as far as the quote-unquote transparency, there wasn't much transparency in the pension bill. They waited to the very last minute to spring on people, on the council, and, you know, King Curry's going to have his way.
Okay, thanks. And thanks for that, Bobby. And that seems to be, at least among some, the suspicion that this is being done by the powers that be with not enough weigh-in from the public. A.G. Gankarski.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the pension process, ironically, there was a lot of publicly reported back and forth. I mean, so much of the pension deal was negotiating with the unions, the executive branch, the mayor's office, that negotiates the deals with the unions. And I sat in on a lot of these meetings where they talked about collective bargaining terms. They talked about, well, how much of the contribution would be for the defined contribution plan and so on. So that was a process that by the time it got to the city council level was pretty well cooked. With this one, it's a different process because city council, you know, needs to indicate its willingness to move forward exploring a sale before anything can actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, before I was talking about what would happen if council's will seemed ambivalent on it, you discourage some of those buyers who, ironically enough, could run the utility better than some of the others. It's like you could get hedge funds, you could get international players.
Interesting.
To factor into it. And, you know, that's the thing. I don't think there's any inclination to take the highest dollar value so much as, you know, a composite of the highest dollar value combined with, well, can they actually run a utility?
That's a pretty specific skill set.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That limits it to players in the market, like some, yeah, as you mentioned earlier on.
And quickly, let me go through this email on our Facebook, or our post on our Facebook page from Jim. Sunshine State News reports potential buyers are Duke Energy, Tampa Electric, Florida Power and Light, and Tampa Electric. Duke Energy owns the Crystal River nuclear plant and has been plagued by design flaws that required expensive repairs. Tampa Electric, TECO, is facing costly repairs and decommissioning their old and dangerous coal-fired plants. Well, that's like JEA.
Exactly.
Florida Power and Light owns the old, crumbling, leaking, and apocalyptic Turkey Point nuclear plant. Southern Company owns the plant Vogtle nuclear plant in Georgia, behind schedule and billions over budget. All of the above potential buyers need bailouts. It certainly looks as if they are eyeing JEA ratepayers to provide that. All of them can use existing cost recovery laws to pass those expensive items on to the ratepayers. Who will protect us, the JEA ratepayers, from these cost recovery schemes?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that would be part of the negotiation. I mean, if you sell off an asset like this, if you sell off the electric, then it follows that you'd want to have protections for ratepayers. You want to negotiate protections for, you know, displaced employees and so on. But yeah, I mean, every big electric company in this part of the country clearly has some legacy issues, some decisions that were made that mm-hmm. looked good at the time but don't look good now. So, you know, that's something to factor in. But, you know, again, this is the exploratory phase. I mean, this isn't like, you know, council meets and then the utility sold off. I mean, the process is going to take,
sure,
even if it were to kick off timely, it would take at least a year, probably 2 years.
We were discussing on Friday's Media Roundtable, Vero Beach has been wrestling with a sale like this at a much smaller level for several years. It's a long, drawn-out process. Let's go to Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. You're on the radio.
Ah, yes. Good morning. I just wanted to say, in my opinion, I think this is an absolutely foolish proposal that absolutely ignores the fable, the goose that laid the golden egg. I think even the simplest middle school student could construct a graph that would show that over time, what the benefits from a one-time sale will be eclipsed by the consistent revenue that the JEA provides to the city government. I think this is more a case just like the pension reform, where the mayor comes up with a solution that presents the prospect of far bigger problems in the future. I think maybe he's governing on the principle of after me, the deluge. And it concerns me about the future of the city, and that's what I have to say on this issue.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, I mean, there are caveats to that. I mean, obviously, there's JEA contributions, $116.1 million this year. But JEA doesn't pay property taxes either. So that would be some offset to that. So, you know, if you crunch the numbers, it's not quite as bad as, you know, you get some revenue back on property taxes from a private company. You know, that being said, I mean, the idea, this is kind of like taking a lump sum payout. You know, that's something that's not going to be shaken. But you know, if you look at the city's issues, infrastructural issues, ranging from the septic phase that we discussed to the roads to so on, an inability to, you know, bring taxes in line with other big cities. You know, these are things that make revenue generation a different matter. And the fact that we are kind of at the delta of equity prices, we're kind of at the end of the Obama/Trump liquidity boom. You know, these are real issues. So, I mean, we're seeing a different landscape now. And I think that's what, you know, policymakers, at least in the mayor's office and the JEA board and the donor class, are responding to.
Ray on the South Side. Hey, Ray, what are your thoughts?
Hey there. First of all, I love that person with the Facebook post. I thought they nailed that pretty good. But one of the things I noticed was that about 8 months ago, Florida Power and Light started doing an awful lot of television advertising in this market when they have a relatively small share of their customers in the market. And it seems to me that that's part of a campaign to sort of soften the beach. But we should all be aware that their customers call them Florida Plunder and Loot for a reason.
Oh, ouch.
There is a profit margin that corporations have. The only reason a corporation exists is to make a profit. And so, therefore, if you take the operation of the JEA and the contributions that it makes to our community and that sort of thing, and then add the profit on top of that, where is that going to come from? It's going to come from ratepayers. So you can make a one-time windfall right now, and then the citizens of Jacksonville will pay the price for decades to come.
Thanks for that, Ray. Oh, by the way, here's an email that came in the other day from a listener named Milt, and his subject line is "The Real Reasons They Want to Sell." He says, "The first factor is ideology. It's no secret that publicly owned utilities like JEA are anathema to true believing neoliberals and market fundamentalists who believe nothing of this sort should ever be owned or controlled by public bodies. Second, you need to talk about what I call honest graft, the fortunes to be made in terms of consultants, financial middlemen, and transaction fees. And the usual well-connected insiders will all be lining up at the trough to take full advantage of this sale. It may be legal, but it will all be special friends of the mayor and the powers that be who run the city from the sidelines, who will swoop in to scoop up the millions in gravy that will flow out of this deal." A.G. Gankarski, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's the perception right there that the mayor's office, that advocates for the sale are going to have to overcome. You know, that's not going away. I mean, we've heard that in some variation a few different times in this program. Heard it every time we've discussed it previously. It's something that, are the robber barons going to profit, or is this something that's actually for the civic good? And, you know, that I think that was part of what the meeting on Wednesday was supposed to help kick in the gear, you know, sort of JAA framing the narrative that, you know, maybe this is time to explore the sale. That would have been a time that council members could have asked those questions. You know, eventually a meeting like that is going to happen. Eventually, this will be discussed. I mean, if it's discussed in standing committees, if it's discussed, you know, special meeting, that remains to be seen. But, you know, those due diligence questions will be asked. And I guarantee that even people who line up with the mayor's office on most issues will ask those questions.
Todd on the South Side. Hello, Todd. Good morning to you.
Oh, thank you. I have a post on Jay. I have two comments and a quick question. First comment, I think Jay's been very responsive to the needs and input of the public. We'll lose that input ability. Number two, once JEA goes private, it becomes under control of the Public Utilities Commission in Tallahassee. Currently, JEA is installing renewable energy at three times its prior pace. The PUC 10 years ago, under the influence of high-paid lobbyists, prevented there being a renewable portfolio standard for the private utilities. JEA then would be privatized and under the evil influence of the Public Utilities Commission that opposes renewable energy. Quick question. Has anyone talked about the abundant natural resources, the tens of thousands of acres that JEA owns? What will happen to those lands? Are they going to be sold off and developed when we sell out?
Thanks for that question. That's a good question, too.
Yeah, the land use question is an interesting one because a lot of these properties are sort of shared use. You know, there's multiple private and public vendors have access to those right-of-ways, and negotiating those property rights deals, negotiating this dispensation of property would be part of the sale, would be a complicating factor, something that the valuation report draft form referred to. It would be one of the things be brought into bearing. You know, regarding the caller's other contentions, you know, the Public Utilities Commission and all that, you know, that's something that, you know, I think will factor in, too. It's like, and do you really want to control, like, let's say Ron DeSantis is governor? Do you feel comfortable with that particular commission under his watchful eye controlling it? I mean, these are questions that, again, the policymaking body, the city council, is going to have to consider.
Thank you for that segue, because I do want to make quick note of new data that came out this morning from UNF's Public Opinion Research Laboratory. As we look at the upcoming governor's race, not good news for any of the candidates, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Nobody's heard of any of these people. They have some work cut out for them to even get their name out there. The Republican candidates, 72% have never heard of Congressman Ron DeSantis. 67% have never heard of Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. 78% have never heard of House Speaker Richard Corcoran. How about that? And then on the Democratic side, it's about the same numbers for the front runners, Gwen Graham, former congresswoman, and Andrew Gillum, current mayor of Tallahassee. Nobody knows who they are either.
Yeah, and those numbers you cited are even worse with the population of all voters. I mean, those are the primary voters, but they're registered voters. They're not the likely voters. So you've got to ask yourself, who turns out the vote in a primary in a midterm year? You know, and these are going to be your super voter types, your motivated voters. On the Republican side, will probably be your older, you know, your older culturally conservative types. On the Democratic side, will probably be, you know, an older crowd also, just because of the self-selecting nature of the primary audience. There's no Clinton versus Trump thing to juice turnout. But yeah, all of these candidates are kind of blank slates. They all kind of have to define themselves. And for somebody like Adam Putnam, who's been at it for a year, he's been campaigning for a year.
And his name is on a lot of official material that goes out to a lot of people, too.
Right.
So kind of surprising.
Every time I steal gas from the gas station, I see his name on the sticker.
So,
you know, it's like that. But, you know, how well known are these candidates? I mean, that's going to be something that, you know, it's going to bedevil them up until the general election, really. But with the primaries, you know, the thing I looked at was the favorables. On the Republican side, Putnam had the best favorable ratio Corcoran had the worst. Corcoran was barely above water, even Republicans. That raises questions. And on the Democratic side, Gwen Graham was doing the best in terms of favorability versus unfavorability. So those campaigns have the best pulse. I mean, Philip Levine, a Miami Beach mayor, spent a lot of money. He hasn't gotten a lot of traction yet for it. Ron DeSantis, he's on Fox News all the time. He's got the Trump endorsement for what it's worth. I mean, there hasn't been much beyond that tweet. But, you know, all these guys, you know, they should take this poll sort of a wake-up call. They need to refine their messaging and make sure to get their voters out.
Always good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
A.G. Gengarski writes for Florida Politics. Much more still ahead, meanwhile. Later, how you can deliver a barbershop quartet to your sweetheart this Valentine's Day. Don't miss our live in-studio performance here on the show. But up next, a conversation with best-selling author Jeanette Walls. Her book, The Glass Castle, became a movie last year, and she's coming to town. We'll tell you about it right after this.
My question is, why is the Earth called Earth?
On the next Radiolab.
Are there more stars in the universe or grains of sand on Earth?
Is it cleaner beneath the sticker of the apple?
What's up with traffic jams?
Random questions like,
helium is a finite resource. Why are we wasting it on balloons?
How do fish hear?
Why do some birds walk and others hop?
I don't know why.
We're going to try and answer some of these questions.
I just wanted to get to the bottom of it.
On the next Radiolab.
Sundays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, New York Times bestselling author Jeanette Walls is renowned for her riveting memoir of her unconventional and dirt-poor childhood, The Glass Castle. In the book, she tells the story of how her nomadic parents raised her and her siblings bouncing around the country with periods of homelessness, and then, for a time, living in a rat-infested shack in Welch, West Virginia, with no plumbing or heat. Resilient, hopeful, though often hungry, Jeanette knew even as a kid that if she was going to have a better life one day, it would be up to her to make it happen. So eventually, she and her siblings left their parents and made their way to New York, where Jeanette Walls paid her own way through college and then became a successful gossip columnist, chronicling the lives of the rich and famous for publications like New York Magazine and Esquire. All the while, though, she was keeping her past a secret until she finally wrote about it in her incredible memoir. Now, The Glass Castle was made into a film last year, starring Woody Harrelson and Naomi Watts as Jeanette's parents, and Brie Larson as Jeanette. Take a listen.
If the sun don't shine.
Let's go, kids! Venture on our tails.
He means the bill collectors.
And if the subway's flat.
The kids are tired of moving to a new town every time you lose a job.
You know, all this running around is only temporary. We just need perfect location, then we can get to work on our castle.
This place doesn't have any running water or electricity.
Ignore her. She was born without vision.
Jeanette Walls speaks in Jacksonville next week. It's one hot ticket. It's an evening sponsored by the Jacksonville Women's Network. She's on the line now with a preview. Jeanette Walls, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, I have to tell you, for years I would read your work online. For a while you were writing, I think, for MSNBC.com.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, and then when and I would see your little icon and I knew you had red hair. Your profile picture on MSNBC.com, I could tell you were a redhead, and I loved your column, and I thought, oh, here's this sassy New York redhead. What a glamorous life she leads, writing all about the glitterati in New York City. And then you came out with your memoir, and I was absolutely knocked flat.
Yeah, appearances can be deceiving. But, you know, one of the great things that I've learned after having told my story is how many of us there are out there. I'll be standing in line at some fabulous event, and somebody would be there waiting for have their book signed. And I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, you know, what would that rich, stuck-up woman know about somebody like me? And she'll come up and just say, girlfriend, you and I could be sisters.
Wow.
And they'll tell me their story, and it's a lesson I just keep learning. Never jump to conclusions about people. You know, we all have a story. And some of us are dirt poor, but some of us also just, you know, poor folk haven't cornered the market on weirdness. So we all have a story. And so that's one of my missions, is to get people to come to terms with their story, whether it's highfalutin or dirt poor. You know, I just think that by confronting our past, we find the best in us. Sometimes the things that we think are what makes us less of a person are the best thing that we have going for us.
Sure. And when you put it all down on paper and you revealed your childhood to the world, was that, I know this sounds cliche to ask, but was it like lifting a burden? Was it freeing?
Well, I'll tell you first. I'll be honest with you, I was terrified. I was practically in a fetal position under my desk. I thought, I can't let people know these things about me. Most people were like you. They thought like, oh, she's so glamorous. She's got this incredible life. And I didn't want to shatter the illusion. Hmm. And it was the most cathartic thing I've ever done. No, it's not a cliche. It lifted a huge burden. But beyond that, and now we're going into cliche territory, it was empowering. Mm-hmm. Because I'd spent a lot of energy pretending I was somebody I wasn't. And once you stop spending that energy being fake, then you can be real.
And do you feel that you're a different person now, in a sense?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. My husband says it's completely changed me. But he said it's really just made you more of who you always were. Mm. But I can just be so much more open. And, you can be yourself. But again, the number of people who've come up and told me their stories, and it's the most bizarre thing for me, because sometimes they'll start crying and they'll say, I'm so ashamed. I've never told anybody this before. And I want to say, why would you be ashamed of that? That's a great story. And when I see this person telling me this story of poverty or hardship or a loony parent, I don't think less of that person, but I understand why they think it's shameful. And it's just something I think we've got to get past.
Sure.
It's thinking that our past somehow makes us less of a person somehow, that we can't come clean about it. I mean, there is such a thing as too much information too soon. I get that. But I think that people are doing themselves a huge favor by coming to terms with their past. Yeah.
Now, of course, you made a huge splash with The Glass Castle, and you've gone on to write other books since then. And then last year, Oscar nominee Woody Harrelson playing your dad, Oscar winner Brie Larson playing you.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that had to have been, I would think, a surreal experience to go see your life on the big screen like that.
Well, I have to say, it was also, again, eye-opening. These actors, it's so easy. You know, I made a career out of making fun of rich, famous, fabulous people. You know, I wrote about what shallow, tacky people these actors were. And then having spent time with them, they knocked my socks off with their empathy and their willingness, their passion to understand, their passion to get to the truth of the story. And the questions that Woody Harrelson asked me about my father, they were so basic and so real. I mean, I was all prepared with these anecdotes and these psychological analyses of my father, my interpretation. And Woody asked me these really basic questions, like, did he look you in the eye when he talked to you? What did he do with his hands? He just wanted to get it right. And Brie Larson was the same way. She was, she's so open and vulnerable. And I have zero acting talent. So talking to these actors, it was really interesting. And she told me about herself. She said, I'm squishy. I pick up everything, and it's something that makes her very vulnerable, but it also, it's her talent. She sees and feels and hears everything. Mm. And I think that a lot of these actors are just, they're very vulnerable people. I gotta say, I Ella Anderson, who played the 10-year-old me, I just was just blown away by her intelligence and empathy. She had some tough scenes too. And Naomi Watts probably had the toughest job capturing my mom. I think that Naomi Watts understands my mother better than she understands herself. So I thought it would be a little bit weird and exploitative, but it was the opposite, because these actors were just so passionate about the psychology of these really complicated people and the paradoxes of them. And, you know, we're all paradoxes, but that's what these actors are interested in, is capturing not just the bad, but the good and the bad and the vulnerable and the strong. And to see them at work, it was kind of breathtaking.
Sure. And, you know, your story, I think, for so many is so powerful, because all of us, in a sense, have to come to terms with our parents and
yep.
their flaws and their failings.
Yep.
But your story, my gosh, what a journey for you. And is your mother still living?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I moved her. She lives with me, not with me, because I'm not a saint, but I built a place for her out back. And it's been really interesting getting to know her better now that I'm my ripe old age. Huh. And, you know, now that I'm not looking for her to take care of me, she's a really neat, interesting person. She was just maddening when I wanted her to be a more conventional mother. But if I can accept her for what she is, she's a really fascinating woman. My husband has never met anybody like her, and he's great intellect, and he said, I've never met anybody as smart as she is. She's kind of a hoarder. Which I didn't realize, because our houses were always getting burned down or we'd leave them before she could accumulate much. But as with many hoarders, she's also a hoarder of information. And it's, you know, it's a constant struggle to try to keep her place clean, but to talk to her is just fascinating.
Well, you're fascinating, Jeanette Walls, and there is so much excitement that you are coming to town. Mm. So we so appreciate you giving us just a few minutes, a preview of your talk here. Thanks for being on the line with us.
Thank you. Looking forward to seeing Jacksonville.
We are too. It's an evening with best-selling author Jeanette Walls. It's next Thursday, February 22nd, at the Jacksonville Marriott on Salisbury Road. Get your tickets now. They're going fast. Go to jackswomensnetwork.com, and we'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
Coming up on The Next Reveal, Tennessee Watson was sexually molested as a kid. Decades later, she told the police about the man who abused her.
He isn't isolated. He does still work with young people.
But getting justice wasn't easy.
Really, the prosecutor is the linchpin. The buck stops with him. He can reject a case just because he doesn't want to do it.
On The Next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/hd.
Welcome back. Well, here's a Valentine's Day gift for your sweetheart that won't add to their calorie content. It's the Sapphire Quartet. They're part of Jacksonville's Harmony Chorus, and they're performing all around the town this week with some singing Valentines. Barbershop quartets for your sweetie. What could be better? The Sapphire Quartet is here in studio now with a live in-studio performance. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Susan Brooks, you're here to kind of speak for the group.
Yeah.
Okay, so these singing Valentines are super popular. You guys are in demand.
We absolutely are. And this year, because Valentine's Day is on a Wednesday, I think a lot of people, there's much more flexibility for us to deliver to places of business and things like that. So we are very much in demand this year.
If people go to jacksharmony.com, they can learn all about the Jacksonville Harmony Chorus. You're a member of Sweet Adeline's International.
Correct. We are at Jacksonville Harmony is a chapter of Sweet Adeline's International.
And this is something everyone can get excited about, a cappella barbershop harmony.
Absolutely. I mean, a cappella is so popular in colleges, and you see it on TV
Pitch Perfect
and all of that. So, yeah, I encourage any woman who likes to sing to come check out our chorus.
Now, there are still a few slots left for you to be sent out and booked for Valentine's Day,
yes,
correct?
Yes, we have two quartets who are going to be combing the city, delivering these wonderful singing telegrams. But we can only do so many, but there is a few spots available.
Okay, well, we're so excited because we have a preview right now as the Sapphire Quartet is going to sing a little Valentine's Day song. What are you singing, ladies?
I Don't Know Why.
Here they are, the Sapphire Quartet.
I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do. I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do. I don't know why you thrill me like you do. I don't know why you just do. Yes, you do. You always seem to want my romancing. I love the way you hold me when we are dancing. I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do. I just do.
Clapping all by myself. That gives me chills.
Thank you.
Those Barden Bellas have nothing on you, ladies. Can I just say that right now? Let me just say that right out loud. Anna Kendrick needs to learn the Cup song from you.
Yeah, there we go.
Right?
Sure I hear that,
but. Hey, we still have 2 minutes. Can you do another one for us before we go to break?
Oh, wow.
Am I putting you on the spot?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We can.
Go to jacksharmony.com to book your singing Valentine from the Sapphire Quartet, part of the Jacksonville Harmony Chorus. We're going to hear some more.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. And tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone.
Don't have nobody
to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Mr. Sandman,
bring me a dream.
Give him a pair
of eyes with that come hither gleam.
Give him a loving
heart like Pagliacci. And lots of wavy hair like Liberace. Sandman.
Yes?
Someone to hold would be so peachy before she's too old. Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me. Please, Mr. Sandman.
Pornography can give teenagers a very skewed perspective on sexuality and intimacy. That's got some folks considering a new kind of sex education, what you might call porn literacy. Parts of the country are changing their minds and their laws about equipping young people to discern fantasy from reality. Pornography, puberty, and perspective. Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air...
When you think you're going to die, you really start to feel like you're fading to gray and everyone else is still in color.
Kate Bowler was diagnosed with incurable cancer in her 30s. She's married, has a young child, and teaches at Duke Divinity School. Her new memoir is about how her religion has affected how she deals with illness and how illness has affected her faith. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
You've got decompostable garbage. What do you do with it?
Do people actually want to compost? Like, maybe I don't have to work quite so hard at, like, trying to convince them that this is a good idea.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, starting a business with other people's food scraps. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
While the residents of Key West are still recovering from Hurricane Irma, tourists on board cruise ships are returning to the historic town. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Robert Kirstein, author of Key West on the Edge. We'll discuss the 1840 attack on Indian Key and Norman Film Studios in Jacksonville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, football season is over. Spring training is just around the corner, but there's still a lot of sporting news to talk about.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
If you're a little out of sorts now that the NFL season is over, never fear. Cole Pepper is here. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, we do have some things to talk about, particularly in our area. With the Daytona 500, which is Sunday.
That's
yesterday,
right.
They set the front row, and a familiar car with an unfamiliar face behind the wheel, Dale Earnhardt's former car, number 88, Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s car, driven by 24-year-old Alex Bowman, set the pace. He'll start on the pole on Sunday. A couple of other storylines to keep an eye on at the World Center of Speed. Danica Patrick will run her last NASCAR race when she... if she qualifies, she should later this week. She'll also run the Indy 500, then retire, perhaps to spend more time with boyfriend Aaron Rodgers, the Packers quarterback. The Great American Race is Sunday, but there are other races Thursday, Friday, and Saturday as well. All right, so once we get past that, I think a lot of attention in the sporting world in Northeast Florida, Southeast Georgia will be turning to college basketball. Not quite to March Madness yet, but we're starting to get a pretty good picture. This has been a wild college basketball season, by the way. Nobody can stay at the top of the polls. Whether you're a blue blood or an upstart, nobody can seem to get a long string of wins put together. So I think it's going to be a wild tournament once it rolls around. The Gators got a couple of wins this past week, so they're looking better after a little bit of a shaky start. The Seminoles going in the other direction. I think both teams will make the tournament, but they need to get things firing on all cylinders by the time March rolls around. JU and UNF both battling in the A-Sun, and it's going to be fun because these two teams, who are currently third and tied for fourth in the conference, will play the final week of the season. They have two more games to go, but then the final game of the regular season is at JU between these two, and that could decide maybe who hosts a postseason game at home in the A-Sun tournament and who will have to go on the road.
That'll be a fun game to go to.
Should be good. And both teams probably feeling like if they can sneak a win in the tournament would be a successful season. Golf, we still are a ways away from May, which would be the Players' Championship, but the swing to Pebble Beach produced an unlikely victor, Ted Potter Jr., Ocala native, playing in a field that included eight former number one players in the world. So this is a stacked field. He won for just the second time. This is a guy who stepped off a curb in Canada in August of 2014 and broke his ankle. That kept him out of golf for 2 years. Then he was back to the minor leagues a year ago. And his only other victory was at the Greenbrier Classic in 2012. He'd missed the cut in 55% of his PGA Tour events in his career.
Is this like a tin cup type thing? Guy coming from out of nowhere to win a big one?
And not just that he won this one, but against whom? You know, he was playing with Dustin Johnson, the world's number one ranked player, most of the weekend, and he basically went nose to nose with him and outplayed him. So a really impressive performance by Ted Potter Jr. I don't know if this is one of those one-hit wonders or maybe a second-hit wonder, but we'll keep an eye on him. He's left-handed. You don't see many of those on the tour either. The Winter Olympics going on as well. By the way, I will point out that I have been asked several times about curling over the last couple of days.
People connect you to that for some reason.
Well, remember when the USA Championships were here and I went down there and Lindsay Kilbride and I were just talking about that story she did.
You did a little curling yourself.
I curled a bit, Melissa. I don't mean to brag. But
weren't you pretty good?
I mean, legend has it. I can neither confirm nor deny.
You don't like to brag.
No, I'll leave that to others to brag after
modest.
I prompt them.
You're a humble man.
I am. One of my many virtues. But the United States right now in fourth position. If medal count is indeed what matters in the Olympics, and I think we can all agree that that's the best way to prove who the best country is, at least in the summer games. Winter games, I'm not so sure. But the United States now with four total medals, two golds, including the most recent, Jamie Anderson winning on the snowboard. I don't know if it's yesterday or today now in Pyeongchang. International Dateline comes into play at some point, and you have to figure out where that all plays in. Still to come, though, we're going to see a Jacksonville connection in the Olympics. Former Jacksonville roller girl turned speed skater. Erin Anderson will be competing, and what an impressive story. Just 4 months. I'm sorry, I said Erin Anderson. Erin Jackson. 25 years old, 4 months of speed skating on the ice, and I'm told by one of her teammates that she was amazing on the roller rink and that she was both fast and nimble as a roller derby competitor. Also the first African-American woman to make the U.S. Olympic speed skating team. She races in the 500 meters on Sunday. She did not participate in the opening ceremonies because of an illness. She's hoping to be ready to go this weekend.
I love it. From Jacksonville Roller Girls to the Olympic Games.
Isn't it great?
And how about that?
Former Florida Gator. She also was an engineering student at Florida. So pretty impressive young lady, to be sure.
Last but not least, the 26.2 with Donna was yesterday. And a local runner, you say, won the 110-mile ultra marathon.
Yeah, and an impressive performance. Mark Burgett is a Jacksonville runner who ran 84 miles on Saturday, then turned around and ran the seventh fastest marathon yesterday to run 110 miles in total, fastest in a small group of competitors there. What made this a great story is that Mark's wife is a breast cancer survivor, and she and their daughter were the ones who were holding the tape as he crossed the finish line to finish things off. And one of the most impressive endurance athletes you'll ever meet, and one of the nicest guys you'll meet in Jacksonville as well.
How nice is that? Always good to see you. Thanks for being here. Lots of sports to talk about all year round with Cole.
Always something to say.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper, and that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Kevin Mershart, who has never tried Olympic-style curling, to my knowledge. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour, and our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. And if you missed any portion of today's show, catch the rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next with a look at who should determine legislative districts. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.